Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
So this week I'm not sick, but Bill is, so we've traded places. We're not happy through the winter if somebody isn't down the drain.
That's right.
Don't really know why that is. So not a lot of announcement-y kind of stuff today. I really wanted to get right to our guest because we watched the documentary last night. Michael Pack is the producer and director of The Last 600 Meters. He's the president of Manifold Productions and an independent film and television company founded in 1977. He has written, directed, and produced numerous award-winning nationally broadcast documentaries, as well as corporate and educational films. He's also the president of Palladium Pictures. So I looked at the list of all of these. There's so much more information. I hope you will go to the website. Today is November 30th, 2025, post-Thanksgiving. Hope you all had a good time with your family, provided you got to go. It seemed like this was the year that everybody's plans changed, though, so I don't know.
Oh, yeah, the airlines were a mess.
Everybody had plans, and somebody got sick, and that was the end of that. It just seemed like I heard that from a lot of people. But so you had a little extra time to watch things, and you've got one day left before you go back to work. I would encourage you, get on, we found it on PBS Documentary, and I'm sure Michael can give us more places. But Manifold Productions and Palladium Pictures, both of those sites were super interesting. And the one thing I didn't want to miss out was the quote from General James Mattis, who was, Mad Dog Mattis, everybody knows who he is. And he said about this this documentary, "The Last 600 Meters reveals the infantry's world as has seldom been seen by those who have not experienced it. This film, uncaptured by politics or ideology, reveals the most bruising ethical environment on earth and the character of the young men that our nation sends in harm's way. It's infantry." And honestly, to say that it is absent of politics and all that sort of thing, which is what our show is about quite a bit, really and truly there was no judgment, no interjecting there, and you really couldn't figure out, Michael, if you thought that the war effort was a good idea or a bad idea, which is really quite a testament to your film skills.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Well, that is how we intended it. I think that's really high praise from General Mattis, who was really the guiding force in the first Battle of Fallujah. So, and he knows of what he speaks, so I'm flattered by that. And, yeah, your listeners can watch the film on Amazon. They can just, search for The Last 600 Meters. I think it's $2.99, so it's, I think, even a good deal by Amazon standards. And then, as you say, I've done 15 or so films that have been on nationally broadcast, mostly on PBS, and they can all be findable. They're all findable through our websites, Manifold Productions and Palladium Pictures. And the very last one, before this one, was one about Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
Some of your listeners might have seen Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words, and that is also on Amazon, actually.
That was amazing. There's one on the birth of nuclear power, and
yes.
Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, Rodney King. I saw that. I didn't see the documentary, but I saw that on your list, and I thought, well, that must have been interesting to unravel.
It was. I think it's, we made it about 10 years after the incident occurred, and we interviewed Rodney King, which you cannot do anymore since he's passed away, and several of the police that were charged. And I think it's actually a model in a way for all the post George Floyd and George Floyd himself, all these controversies and riots where they're vastly misunderstood. In that case, there was this brutal beating of Rodney King with first tasers and then batons, and the cops felt, he was on PCP, he kept attacking them. They felt happy they didn't have to use lethal force, but the beating was videotaped. It looked brutal to everybody. It was brutal. And in the end, those policemen were charged with excessive force, and the idea was maybe in the batoning of Rodney King, maybe the last five or six baton strokes were excessive. But no one denied that some of them were not, and they were following police procedure. But one thing that Rodney King incident was not, it was not racist. These cops were not racist. You know, there was one that's Hispanic, one of them had adopted black children. I mean, they just were not racist. It wasn't racially motivated. Maybe it was excessive force, that's debatable. But it became an icon in the history of race in America. And why? I mean, it's just one of those things where it's a total media creation. I mean, in the sense that it's a symbol of racism. So that tends to happen. I mean, it's the same with George Floyd. Was he killed by that police officer Chauvin, or was he not? Yes or no, hard to tell. It doesn't seem to me to be racially motivated by Derek Chauvin. I mean, so a lot of these things are a symbol of racism when they're provably not based on race. And the Rodney King was the first of those. And you can see it happen in the course of that film, you know, how it goes from the first videotaping to then it becomes a cause celeb and who picks it up and how it's used politically. So I think a great film. It's an hour, and you can watch it and find it on our website.
Yeah, and then, I mean, think about what that was the spark of so much to come after that.
It was.
I bet that's just absolutely frustrating, especially when you're trying to document all these things, and as you're peeling all this apart, you look and you go, wow. All of this was just misconstrued.
Indeed. You know, that is certainly a problem. And, you know, it's picked up for political reasons and you know, it's completely changed. I think those of us, and I include both of us, Aaron, in the media, you know, it's the media. We have a lot of responsibility to bear.
Oh, yeah. Well, nobody wants to put something out there that isn't going to, but it goes with interviews, it goes with, you see it all the time. I mean, even you look at, in our members of Congress, there are 535 people on the Hill, and what do we hear from? Eight of them?
That is very true.
You know, we hear from eight people who say really incendiary things, and they seem to grab all the headlines. They're not necessarily the smartest. They're not necessarily doing the most work. But they're loud, and they get everybody wound up. And so, well, let's definitely put them in front.
That's quite true. I mean, it's a real distortion in our political life, no doubt. And that's why I'm flattered that General Mattis saw that we did not put ideology or politics in the last 600 meters. I mean, I have my own views about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, but that one we tried to tell the story, as you know, having watched it, from the point of view of the people who fought there, from corporals and sergeants up to the one-star generals that were in the field actually fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, it's called the last 600 meters because a Special Forces sniper says, "I don't make foreign policy, I deliver the last 600 meters of it." Meaning what he could see through the sniper scope. And that's what we tried to stay true to, what the battle looked like from the ground truth. And we tried to tell it as a battle story, as if it were any battle, Gettysburg, Iwo Jima, any famous battle. And I think that people should try to understand the battles for what they are, an important part of American history, and not see it clouded by the ideology. And even though it took us many years to make, this might be the right time for it to be out there.
Well, I thought that, I mean, and you didn't, it was also a really good balance between things that were really gory. I mean, the contractors that were hung from the scaffolding and dragged through the street. So you included that. But then there were also the conversations between the guys and them singing, like, the Mickey Mouse Club and, you know, stuff like that. It was, you weren't just immersed in this punch-you-in-the-face war thing.
We tried to give a feeling for what it's like. I mean, I've never been in battle, but I tried to give a feeling for what those mainly men, but one woman, you know, told us really about what it was like. And as you say, it's the story of the first Battle of Fallujah, the Joff, and the second Battle of Fallujah, the biggest battles America has fought since Vietnam, which is why I think it's worth understanding the story. As you say, the first Battle of Fallujah began when those four Blackwater contractors traveled through Fallujah, were killed, burned, right through the streets of Fallujah. Two of them hung from a bridge while insurgents danced beneath their
corpses. Oh, yeah.
A gruesome image. Yeah, and you can see it. And a gruesome image that really caused the whole thing to start. And even though General Mattis recommended only pursuing those that were guilty, there was a desire to clear out the whole city of Fallujah. And that began this sort of six-month process that the film depicts. And we did try to give you a feel for what it's like, you know, in between the battles, you know, the difficulty, but not go soft on the horrors of war. You know, we did not try to make it, it's not really a rah-rah kind of military film. These people, you can see the courage and valor of these young people that are there in the, you know, doing the fighting, but you can also see the horrors of war, as you said, and we did not want to go light on that.
No, but you also didn't, you didn't include all of the political. You did, but you didn't. You know, the it was very clear that there were things that we, based on the on the ground assessment, things that we should have done that we didn't do. And it's like anyone who was alive during that time period was this 2004. Anybody who was an adult during that time, kind of paying attention even tangentially, was like, oh yeah, and then it got so much worse. So that was kind of hard to know, I guess.
Well, we tried to give it what it was like when these sort of changing political winds, you know, hit the battlefield, what it was like, how the troops on the ground responded. So, yeah, so that just to start the recap the beginning of the story. So then they go into the, because of this horrific image, the military is ordered to clear the city. But then the Marines clearing the city, you know, Al Jazeera and others are made make that look also barbaric and vicious. And because of that, the Marines are told to halt halfway through. A horrible position to be in. You know, you're standing there in a position with, you know, a fixed position where insurgents can know where you are. But then they negotiate with the insurgents, and they're told to pull out and hand the city over to, essentially to the insurgents, the Fallujah Brigade, to run as they see fit without any military oversight, in which case Fallujah turns into this hellscape. You know, it's an arms depot. It's a place for insurgents to rest between from city to city. There are torture chambers, and then finally there are beheadings there. And the image of the beheadings causes the second battle of Fallujah 6 months later. But you can see the Marines in and out and in and out. You know, what it's like to be told first you're going to take Fallujah, and then you're going to pull out. And as one of these Marines says, yeah, so in the first Battle of Fallujah, first we're fighting them, and then suddenly we're negotiating with the exact same people. But as he says, what's a few RPGs between friends?
Yeah, right. That was a good line.
A very, you know, cynical, bitter comment by an unhappy Marine. But they do what, you know, they're there to follow orders, you know, and you know, in light of the present controversy, these were clearly legal orders, and they didn't hesitate to follow them. So that's right. It was what it was like on the ground. But, you know, my own view, given that we're now talking and I don't have to not inject my own view in, is that, you know, it's very hard to make these calls. You know, it's hard to fight a counterinsurgency. You know, the political forces in the State Department and senior military in Washington were worried about losing the hearts and minds of the Iraqis. You know, you can't have a, you know, so that it's a delicate balance, and clearly we did make mistakes. But the film is meant to see what it's like from the ground, and not necessarily pass judgment on those people making those decisions. You know, clearly in retrospect, a lot of them were wrong, but that is not in the film. I should also say that we were lucky to be able to conduct the interviews for the film 3 years after the battle of 2007. Yeah. So the people we interviewed, you know, their memories were fresh. They look like they do in the footage. And that's how we proceeded. We found the footage of the key moments of the battles. and they found the people in them, so they could talk about the footage that they were in. And they tell the story, as you said, straight to camera, looking right at the audience without any commentary or narration. And they tell what it was like to fight these battles on the ground. So, you know, that's why there is no politics in it. And I think but you do get a sense for the heroism and valor of these young, mainly Marines, not only Marines, but mainly Marine battles. And I think that now, we first did a version of the film in 2008, and PBS initially felt it was too pro-military, which I actually don't think it is, for the reasons you already said, Aaron. I mean, we have all the horrors of war in there, too. But it did take them 17 years to reverse it, and I'm happy that now they have finally broadcast it, and they're distributing it to Amazon and elsewhere. They gave us a great time slot, prime time, the day before Veterans Day, the Marine Corps birthday, 250th birthday. So I think now, 21 years after the battle, we can look back and see what it was like to fight and the heroism of these young people without being clouded by the ideology. It's much easier to do it now, maybe, than it was when we initially finished the film in 2008.
Oh, yeah. I wondered how much pressure there was on that. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back. Our guest is Michael Pack. He is the director of The Last 600 Meters. And if you have not seen that, you really owe it to yourself, even though it seems like an odd time of year to watch a war documentary, and you've probably seen many. This will stand out for you. It's different than most of what is out there. And I think you'll learn a lot, too. Anyway, you can find all that information at wethepeopleradio.us for today, November 30th, 2025. We'll be right back. And I guess I didn't do the other part. And we're back. Bill was fermenting questions over there. They're ready for prime time.
Yeah. I had a thought, Michael. You know, the interviews in the film, I think, were very impactful. I mean, to get it right from the people that were there. How difficult was that to sit down with these folks and relive all that? I mean, it was obviously a very horror-filled battle, and you could see it when you were interviewing them that some of them really struggled with talking about it. How hard was it to interview these folks?
It was. I mean, that's a lot of the work in this kind of a film, is sort of winning these people's trust.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is hard for them to talk about. I mean, you have to spend a lot of time with them before they trust you. And I remember when I went and had dinner with this guy and his wife, and all dinner long, he just wouldn't discuss anything. And then finally, when his wife left, he was willing to talk about it. And one of them, like, actually have trouble talking about it to their own families. I've seen that as a bit of a trend. And so now it's been 17 years since I interviewed them, and we had this screening in Washington recently where I invited a lot of veterans, and they came, they came up for the Q&A, and a lot of them also told me that they want to show it to their families, because even now they can't quite talk about it, and it's sort of easier to show the film than talk about it. So it was hard, and in the end, I think we did get very frank and open discussions from all of them, and so I really appreciate them. You know, you were, it's a gift when people entrust you with their story, especially, as you just said, these difficult emotional stories. Mm-hmm. So It was hard in the beginning, and especially because it was 3 years after the battle. I mean, now they're probably used to telling a kind of expurgated version of it to people who ask. But at the time, the memories were even fresher, and it was all the harder. So, yeah, it was challenging, you know, and it is a gift that I honored. I also said at the time, I promised them that I would get the thing nationally broadcast. It only took me 17 years, but at least I kept my promise.
You did. So, God. Well, what you're spot on with them not wanting to talk about it. We have a family member who was in Beirut right after the whole Beirut barracks bombing. And I don't know what brought the whole thing up, but we were sitting around the pool one day talking about different experiences that he had in Beirut. And he got up to get a drink or something, and his wife was sitting there, and she said, "I've never heard any of this. He's never talked about it," which was amazing.
It's hard. I mean, we had one of the most gratifying things that happened in this meeting when this film was broadcast is that, you know, there's a part of the film where we talked to a bunch of special forces officers and NCOs about their effort to track down high value targets in the middle of the battle of Najaf. And one of them talks briefly about one who was killed in one of these operations. And we heard from his sister, who said, you know, I really never really understood what he was doing, especially because it's a special forces operation. Mm-hmm. I didn't ever understand it. I didn't understand the context. I've been sort of wondering for 17 years, you know, thank you for explaining it, you know. And, you know, it's something that never even occurred to me. And luckily, the person mainly talked about it okay, sending her a little more of his interview to get her that focused on her brother in particular. But that's sort of an example where, you know, you're at a loss and you wonder. And, you know, so I think that's right. It's a difficult process. And I hope that the being in the film and talking in the film is part of a healing process and not just a difficulty. But, and, you know, we never push people to tell something they don't want to tell. I mean, right now, we have another military-themed film that we're working on. We are doing a series of short documentaries with the Wall Street Journal opinion section. We've done two already. Those are totally free outside the Wall Street Journal paywall at wsj.com/opiniondocs or findable through our palladiumpictures.com website. We have two that are completed, but one of the three in development is on the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And those Marines that were at Abbey Gate and the other gates during the very chaotic withdrawal also have a hugely difficult time talking, and a large number have said they just don't want to relive it. And I'm totally sympathetic, and we only try to interview those who feel comfortable, for whom it is therapeutic, and want to get the word out to others. So, yeah, it's always a difficult and challenging process.
Yeah, I think the only way you're going to get the real story and the truth is by interviewing these fellows that were there and lived it, you know, and that's just got to be incredibly difficult to interview and to talk about when you see what they went through.
Indeed, it is difficult. And, you know, these battles are complicated. I mean, in the case of the last 600 meters, these three battles, Fallujah, Najaf, the second battle, Fallujah, they're vast. Huge number of people are involved. So, you can't just tell the story from the point of view of the grunts, of the corporals and the sergeants that are clearing houses. You've got to also tell it from the point of view of majors and captains and, you know, colonels. You know, so it's a complex thing. And in the end, you know, you're only giving a piece of it. You hope you give enough pieces to give a feeling for the battle. But they're vast, huge, you know, many thousands of people over a big area. And that's actually true for even Civil War battles. You know, you see reenactors, a few dozen reenact it, something that took thousands. And it's very hard to give the full sense of what it's like and the scale and the level of challenges and decisions at all the layers of the command. So,
well, the part that really struck me, my brother was Special Forces during the 80s, and he when he came back I mean, everyone says the same thing. He was really different when he came back, which we were I was just out of college, so, you know, what did we know? But as you get older, you realize, okay, that was the change. That was just a change. He went through things that we didn't know anything about. But the thing that stuck with all of us that meant nothing at the time, because it was the 80s, right? We didn't have computers. We didn't have all these movies about this stuff. We knew nothing about the Middle East. We knew nothing about the Middle East, honestly. And when he came back, I remember him having a really kind of aggressive conversation with my mom, who really believed everybody was basically nice and that people didn't need to carry guns and that police were going to save you from everything. And she grew up in a world like that, which was a great world for her. But my brother said, "You have no idea how little these people value human life. It is a totally different mindset, and we will fight." He said, "We will fight them over there forever, or they will come here. And if they come here, they will go through us like a hot knife through butter, because we are wholly unprepared with the barbarity." And I mean, that was 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I don't forget how old I am now. 40 years ago, and I watched that movie, and I thought, "There you go."
Well, too, you also have to realize these were kids. I mean, a lot of these that were fighting over there were 18 to 20, 22. I mean, young. Haven't really experienced a whole lot.
No, but the things that the enemy was willing to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But this is something that they have to be saddled with now the rest of their lives, the experiences that they went through. And
indeed, it's a lot to ask them to bear, but you are quite right, Aaron, about the barbarity of it. I mean, that's why, I mean, in the sort of director's cut, we show a little more of this beheading that motivated the Second Battle of Fallujah, because otherwise the Marines do look barbaric if you don't understand the barbarity of the enemy they fought. And that particular thing, the beheading, you know, these beheadings were not different. Those were videos that were not hard to find. You know, the insurgents put it, this is Al-Qaeda in this case, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi, they put it on their website. For them, it was a recruiting video. They wanted the world to see it. And these beheadings are not just, you know, kind of like a ritual murder, you know, where you put a gun to someone's forehead and shoot. You know, it takes a long time to behead someone. And the actual videos on the website are long. And then, you know, they hold up the head, the beheaded head, you know, in their hands, hanging from, with the, you know, by the hair, in front of the camera, with the blood dripping. And it's a sign, you know, it's a very barbaric ritual of a kind, you know, sending a very clear signal about what they're willing to do. I mean, they do it on purpose. They broadcast to the world on purpose. And we have a very expurgated version in the PBS and the Amazon version. But I'm glad that it's at least hinted at, because
the point got through. It was actually really well done. It wasn't like, "Oh, we need to turn this off." Well, I wouldn't have done that anyway, but it, even for, like, because I was thinking about, my mom's gone now, but I thought, I wonder if my mom watched this, if she would have understood what he was telling her all those years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's, and then, to your point, so then the Second Battle of Fallujah happens, and this time, to avoid the negative publicity from the first battle, the Marines announce they're clearing when they're going to clear the city. And so they encourage all civilians to leave, and maybe 80% left, as did the leadership of the insurgency. You know, they're not idiots. They all went to nearby Ramadi. So the people remaining in Fallujah, some civilians, and then the insurgents were actually ready to die. Their only goal was to kill as many Marines as they could before they would die and, you know, go to heaven and get their 73 virgins or whatever it is. So they were taking amphetamines, whatever they could, and to kill as many. And as one of the sergeants says, Sergeant Piano says, you know, they're not afraid to die. How do you fight them? They're not only not afraid to die, they're willing to die. So it's a particularly brutal battle for that reason. And I think it is important, you know, to understand that, you know. And then to your point about the being young, and then, you know, Sergeant Piana, these sergeants and corporals, they're 18, 19, 20, 21. They're right.
He got shot in the head. That whole thing, was amazing, because when the other guy, whose name eludes me because it wasn't Piano, perfect name, when he said, you know, I just saw the Kevlar, it's like, oh my God. Poof. And then all of a sudden, the guy, I actually rolled it back and I looked at the name below and I'm like, wait, that's the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He shot in the head and he's lucky to survive. As he said, too, you know, he felt guilty because, as he said, the Marines, you're not supposed to be shot. You know, he feels he left his Marines, let his Marines down. A very Marine sergeant kind of attitude. But yeah, I mean, before that, you know, they're kicking down doors. They kick down a door in Fallujah. Who's on the other side? Is it a civilian you have to help and give order to? Is it an insurgent who's going to pull a gun and kill you? And you have to decide instantaneously and not make mistakes. And it's really a lot to ask of 18, 19, 20-year-old, you know, young people.
Well, and they were that on-the-ground perspective in all of those battles was like the policy was kind of turning on a dime in some cases. You know,
right.
Okay, we're
going to
go take the whole city. Wait, no, we're going to wait, and we're going to be friends with everyone. Oh, wait.
Yeah. After you've already started.
Yeah,
you know.
Right.
Yeah, after they started. That's right. It's really, yeah, you can see their frustration. Absolutely.
Yeah. That came off, I thought that was all those things. That never makes most of the things we see about these sorts of issues, right? Whether it's a battle or something where you have all this, everyone knows about it. You've seen it on the news, and we watched it for years. But you don't see this level, and that I thought was the most important part. And for the people who were there, I thought it was really a very honorable thing to do for them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you don't really see what it's like on the ground. I mean, a lot of the attention for the Iraqi veterans has been on PTSD and the difficulties coming home, and then horrors like, you know, Abu Ghraib, and all those things are legitimate subjects, but we don't see what they actually was like in the battle. And I think they want us to see that and understand it. And I am glad to be able to do that. And, you know, I hope... You know, so my family is not a military family, unlike both of you. And so we didn't know that many people in the military. So for us, it was very eye-opening to meet and see these people. And I think there's a lot of America, unfortunately, like that. And maybe my film could help close that gap.
Tell me this. I was curious why... Maybe we should take an early... Let's take our break just a little bit early so I don't interrupt. But I was curious why you chose, I mean, of all the different things that we've been involved in as a country overseas, if you were going to do something about a piece of a war, I'm super curious why you chose that and how that came about. I thought about it the whole film. I'm like, the quote, the you know, we don't make foreign policy, we just deliver the last 600 meters. And I thought, if I would have heard that, I would have said, I got to go make a movie about that. But I was curious, how you got the idea. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Loaded guns in your face, and you'll have to do-
So you could have been listening to that song, and you said to yourself, I need to make a movie.
That's true.
Or maybe not.
It's true.
Seriously, what made you think of it?
Well, I had a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to develop a movie about the war in Iraq. It was ongoing at the time,
uh-huh.
So I began the process in 2005 or so. And initially, we were going to do a movie about technology and warfare, which, as you may recall, those listeners old enough to recall might recall, that the beginning of the war in Afghanistan was very focused on technology. You know, a bunch of special forces people had allied with the Northern Alliance, were able to take down the Taliban with the help of extremely, for the time, sophisticated air support. And so they were on horseback, and high-technology weapons were sent with guided missiles to blow out the Taliban, and it all looked like it was going to be a high-tech war. But then, in researching it and running across the veterans of these battles, I saw that there really was another side to it that really, although technology was important, it really depended a lot on the very traditional valor and courage of these young people, and I wanted to tell their story. It's not that far from what you said, Aaron, before the break. You know, you hear somebody say, I don't do foreign policy, I delivered less than 600 meters of it, and it's logical to want to make a film. And that's how we felt, too. I met these guys, and I saw their stories weren't being told, and I wanted to capture it. And I wanted to capture it before it faded. So it took a couple of years, but I'm glad that we did. And I think now it's a historic document. I mean, I completed most of the work on it 17 years ago. I think it's still current. I think it'll be current 10 years from now when people look back on these wars, whatever they think about them then, to get a sense of what it was like to fight them. And I do feel that we will be involved also in this kind of counterinsurgency. The focus today is very much on possible war with China and avoiding war with China. And that's really the appropriate focus. And that would be a very different kind of war. But in the meantime, we are likely to be fighting these kind of insurgencies and counterinsurgencies, like Israel is doing in Gaza, like the urban warfare in Ukraine, or like, you know, maybe we'll be fighting a war in Venezuela. Who knows? But, you know, in the midst of playing out the larger states with China, these smaller things are smaller and not so small wars are likely to erupt, and they will have some of the same qualities as the last war we fought, and they'll be different, and it's important to know the differences, but it's important to understand the history too.
Yeah, the cultural gap was, I mean, it is stark, and it's something that I think the things on the college campuses and all of that, everybody's trying to erase that. Oh, we're all just the same. You know, they believe one thing, we believe another thing. But I have known ever since my brother went to the Middle East in the mid-80s that culturally we are not the same. We are not the same. We do not value the same things. And we do not see life in the same way. We just don't.
It's important to understand that. It's very American to think everybody else is like an American. And clearly, you know, the urge to, as people mockingly say, turn Afghanistan or Iraq into a Jeffersonian democracy, which is not quite what we were trying to do, but it was there, it was a sort of naive thing. They're very different cultures and forces at work in the Middle East. And your brother was quite right about that. So, yeah, I think the gap is very big. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. You know, just recently, you know, these two National Guardsmen were shot by an Afghan refugee, you know, and it raises that question of that cultural gap.
Oh, yeah, big time. Well, it just is one of those things that we ignore that at our peril. Truly, it's not at their peril. It's to their advantage that we. But you know, I always kind of laugh. It's always about kids and dogs, right? If it doesn't work with children and dogs, it's not going to work on anything else. And if you treat your dogs like people, you know, and if you treat your kids like grown-ups, it never works out. You have to look at really what you're working with. I didn't want to get out of here, although we have like 10 minutes left, which seems like a lot, but it just goes really fast. The the thing that your publicist sent to us was your kind of commentary on the six Democrats who are urging military members to refuse illegal orders. And after making this film, you had thoughts.
Well, yeah, I mean, as we were saying earlier, a lot of these Marines did not want to follow the orders they were given, and they thought the orders were going to result in the death of lots of Marines, and they were largely right, but they did follow the orders, and that is sort of essential to the military. Clearly, they're not responsible for doing something, you know, manifestly illegal, and I think that rule is surely meant to apply for, like, a captain or a lieutenant telling a sergeant or corporal to shoot, like, a unarmed prisoner, and for which they should refuse. But it's not clear what they were aiming at these six or however many it is that are suggesting made that video. And the video seems to imply that they can think about what's constitutional and not, and what the president is deciding is or isn't right. And there's a mechanism for that. You know, there's the Supreme Court. You know, there are other courts. You know, there's the Congress. And it does, I think, vastly undercut morale. I mean, I hear them say, all they're saying is, you don't have to, what every soldier knows anyway, that you don't have to follow legal orders. But it sometimes strikes me, as I say, I live in Chevy Chase, a sort of affluent suburb of Washington, D.C., and during COVID, there were a lot of those signs. You know, I believe in science, love is love, so all these things that are essentially tautologies, but that imply something. When they say, I believe in science, they meant, I'm going to follow whatever Dr. Fauci says, which is a fine thing to want to do, but it's not just the tautology that you wrote. And when these people say you don't have to follow legal orders in the tone that they did, they're sort of implying that you should question the orders of this president, in particular, in his, blowing up these boats and in other things and other kind of drug interdiction orders. But I think that's really deeply concerning. I think it's destabilizing to the way the military functions.
Yeah. And I do think that the timing of this, you know, it's interesting. It took all this time for this to come out, but the timing was really excellent because it does make it very, very clear that if everybody was running around deciding whether or not they thought, well, maybe I should do it, maybe I won't do it, it's extremely clear when you watch your documentary that's not how it works.
Even if they're right, and most of the time these guys are right, you know, it is not how it works. The president is elected by the people. He's the commander in chief. That's an important cornerstone of American democracy and of the way the republic is supposed to work. So that's right. You can see it in the film, and these people understand it. You know, they do. You know, so they may not always like it, but they understand it and they have bought into it. And to erode that, I mean, it's putting them in an untenable position, and a really worse and more difficult position.
Yeah, and it's all wrapped up in honor for me. That whole idea that you should question everything and go make your own decisions while everybody else is counting on you to do the part that you have agreed to play, but at your whim, you could change your mind. Well, nobody's got anybody's back in a scenario like that.
You know, that is very true.
I think about them going through that big cemetery. What is it? Najaf.
Yeah.
I looked it up, and everybody said it differently, and I was like, forget it, whatever it is.
Yeah, everybody does say it differently.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know how you really say it.
That's the way the Marines say it. I have a feeling that's not the way the natives of Najaf say it. Najaf, some of them say. Well, that's right.
Could you imagine going through there, and then everybody's making their own decision? Well, I don't know if this order's a good one or not. I think I might want to rethink that.
Right.
Good God,
right.
they all get killed.
One half thinks one, and one half thinks the other, and they're sitting there talking about it. And the longer they're talking about it, you know, the more they're a target. You know, so that's right. It adds another level of confusion, and it was confusing enough.
Yeah,
it is confusing enough in war. they have enough things to sort out of extremely difficult and even ethical nature. So,
well, most like war movies, right? When we, you know, most of us have grown up watching war movies, and most of that is, you know, the general says go, everybody bunches together, everybody gets their stuff together, and then off we go, you know, and it all seems very cut and dried, for the most part, and this really was a window into how sometimes, even in the heat of the moment, things are kind of flexible.
That's right. It's never as clean as it looks in a war movie, and we try to put all that stuff back, because this is reality. That's right. It's not as clean, as simple, or straightforward as it looks.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too, because a lot of times when they say, you know, this is a look, you know, like behind the curtain of some battle or whatever, and it's really just kind of a gory depiction of the horror on the ground, which is all true, but it's not really that thought provoking. It's emotionally jarring, which has its own value too. But this was a little of both. You walked away and you were like, oh. I just don't think anybody, even the people who were there, I think would have a lot of value. Do you get a lot of contact from folks who were in these different battles?
Yeah, and I think it does. I mean, for a lot of them it does. For some of them it adds context, and for others of them, you know, they just want those stories to be out. I mean, these are the biggest battles, and the Jaffe in particular, which, as you say, you know, it's in the south against the Mahdi militia Shiite insurgents, unlike Fallujah in the north. And it's largely forgotten. It's a huge battle, you know. At least the word, people have heard the word Fallujah.
Right.
I don't think they could say anything about what happened there. But Najaf sort of lost. And, yeah, I think it puts it in a context, as I say, like the sister of the guy who fought there. I mean, it was eye-opening for her. And, yeah, I think it's helpful to them. And I agree with you completely, Aaron, that you can't just tell what it's like on the ground. From the vantage point of sort of the grunt, it's always about the guy to the left of them, the guy to the right of them, and their buddies. And in that sense, all battles are the same, you know, from Roman times to today. So you need to put that in the context of why they're fighting and what the strategy is and what the intention is and what the other side is thinking, where there's no, you know, differentiation. You can't understand this battle in particular. So I'm glad that you appreciate that range that we really aimed for.
Yeah, I thought you guys, it was really funny because I found myself, I'd read something on your website. I wanted to find it. There was a quote somewhere on one of your sites that spoke about how you wanted to tell an honest story and leave the politics out. And I thought, oh, nobody leaves the politics out. Oh, this guy's going to secretly have it in there somewhere. I kept watching. I was like, oh, you really didn't. Somehow you actually really didn't.
We didn't in that one. Now, it is true that I myself am politically conservative, but I try to keep my politics out. But I feel strongly that documentaries are well suited to have people from all political points of view representing them, and the documentaries are dominated by people from the left. So one thing that we are trying to do is train other people who are right of center, or at least non-woke. And we have an incubator where we give people a grant to make a short film, and we oversee it and executive produce it and help them make it better and then distribute it. So any of your listeners can apply. It's open for the third round. We had two earlier years of this. If they go to the Palladium Pictures website and the incubator, they could hit the Apply Now button and apply, or encourage somebody they know. I mean, you have to have made a few little films and be able to make another film. So it's not right out of film school, but someone in sort of been out of film school 5 or 6, 7 years, you know, and has a passion project.
Like my engineer Alex Parker's in there making the touchdown arms in the other room. He's like me.
Like him, exactly. He should go there right away.
He should.
Of course, he has to finish the work on your show, Aaron. But we can't
lose him because he's the only one who ever gets the music right, so it's pretty great.
Well, that is important.
That is important because that's what breaks up the talking. Michael, we have to run off. And we're sorry we have to run off. We'd love to have you on again to promote other projects. I think it's nice having a long form and being able to do that. Our guest has been Michael Pack. We really appreciate you coming on. I want to hear about all your family being involved, too. I had so many questions about that, and I kind of ran out of time. So you can find all his work and everything at the site at
wethepeopleradio.us.
Second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
So let's see. Today's November 30th, 2025, just for reference. And you can always find archives that are free to listen to and have no interruptions at wethepeopleradio.us. Information about sponsorships there, too. We thank all the people who chip in on a annual, monthly, weekly, different times. We appreciate your help along the way. Every little bit counts. And that is all for announcements, huh? Got anything?
Yeah, I think you did good.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, that's not a problem.
Are you going to make me dinner tonight?
Yeah, I doubt it.
I know. Bill's been experiencing the magic of shingles. We should do a small commercial. Everyone should run out and get your vaccine. Not big on vaccines, but after watching the shingles episode, I think I'm going to double down there and join the shingles vaccine crew, because it's heinous.
It's been,
you've had the pox for 2 weeks, huh?
Yeah, been 2 weeks.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, everybody says it's bad. It's bad.
It's bad.
It's bad.
Yeah.
So, I guess pox is a good word to use because our guest, Jared Knott, is a historian, so he could tell us all about pox.
The pox.
He's called the pox.
Bring out your dead.
Here we go. Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters is his book. He has two different books, actually. Same title, but the book two. The Many Tiny Mistakes That Changed the World Forever is the one that has just come out, and I thought it was fascinating. He's got all sorts of articles. No pressure, Bill. I didn't tell you about this part. But he's published in the Mensa Bulletin.
Oh.
So probably not a good day to catch you with the Mensa Bulletin. He's had the pox for 2 weeks. Here you go. We got the Mensa guy on. Yeah, that's hard. You, let's see. There was, he's a father of five. I'm the oldest of five. Yeah, live in Atlanta. We've been to Atlanta. After we got married, we went to Atlanta. So, you know, we got a little crossover there, except for the whole Mensa thing.
So much in common.
So much in common. But the thing that caught me on your publicist's email, of course, was Mondami says he still believes Trump is a fascist after a cordial White House meeting. And you had some commentary on that based on a historian's point of view, and I thought, what a great timing on this whole thing. Besides the fact that, I don't know, we've just, honestly, history, it's got to be hard for all of you who are historians to just watch the world. It's like, good grief, doesn't anyone read anymore? History is just continuing to repeat in rapid fashion. Jared, I don't know where you want to start today, but I do want to compliment you on the music for the trailer of Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters. The music is fantastic, actually.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, who's in charge of the music for that?
My daughter, one of my daughters, Elizabeth Ann. My last name is Knott, of course, and I have twin daughters that we had late in life. And they're double knots, okay, of course. So, and I guess if my last name were Peak, I guess they'd be the
Twin
Peaks. And I, but now she put it all together, and also she put the portrait gallery together, which is kind of interesting. Here's like 27 different pictures.
Yeah.
and you hover the cursor over it, and the headline leaps up, summarizing the key headline for that particular personality. Dr. Martin for Eisenhower says, behind the famous grin, there was a man known for his explosive temper, and he was very unforgiving of subordinates who let him down.
Oh, God.
So he could be tough to work for, which is, I'm sure, the way he wanted it. So.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I just thought, what? I read through quite a bit of it, and I went through both of the books, and I thought, well, why don't we know any of these things? This is all, I don't know, just makes history more accessible, I guess.
Yes, of course, in history class, they tend to emphasize the big events, and also they tend to be very positive, especially when it comes to events of the United States. If it's something that was embarrassing or kind of negative, it gets very, very little exposure. If it's something kind of glorious and triumphant, so on and so forth, it gets a little bit more emphasis. But the book, Tiny Bunner's Big Disasters 1 and 2, kind of goes behind the scenes. It looks like the little small mistakes that sometimes have huge, huge impact on the final outcome. So it's kind of turning history sideways, looking at it from a different perspective. And it kind of some details are kind of dirty and kind of embarrassing, and some of them very glorious. So it's kind of a different view of the overall historical record.
How do you, I mean, just out of curiosity, you must have, I don't know, did you stumble across a couple of these and thought, you know, I should write a book?
Well, it's funny. No, it's been, gosh, 12 years since I first had the idea. The very first idea was having to do, here's the teaser for it. It said a single piece of tape rotated several inches the wrong direction, changed the outcome of the Vietnam War. The United States might very well have won, except for this single tiny mistake, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. What we're talking about, pieces of the tape, it has to do with the Watergate break-in. They were told when they jimmied the door from the parking garage into the office building, they were told to hold the striker on the door down with a piece of tape in the vertical position so that the night watchman couldn't see it from the hallway. They made a mistake, and they put it in the horizontal position, so when Frank Wills, that was his name, came walking down the highway, the hallway about 2 o'clock in the morning, he sees this tape on the door. Oh, the door's been jimmied. He calls the Washington, D.C. police. I think he had to call them twice. And so they, and there's a strong rumor that the uniformed officer on duty that part of the city was intoxicated at a local bar and could not answer the call, so they had to send the bum patrol in this place. That's three officers dressed as hobos in a jalopy car. They pull up you see this actually in the old movie, All the President's Men. They pull up into the bar gate. They are not recognized as policemen by the lookout. They come in and arrest James McCord and the Cuban operatives. Watergate begins, boom, 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 boom. Okay, and then Henry Kissinger gave an interview on radio and television. He was, they just signed a treaty with the North Vietnamese. They knew the North Vietnamese were going to be testing the treaty, violating the treaty, so the plan was to go in there and bomb the living daylights out of them again to get them back in compliance, but they were so weak politically they couldn't. South Vietnam collapses, Nixon administration collapses, it all falls apart because of a single piece of tape rotated several inches the wrong direction. And a drunk cop.
Yeah.
I read that, and I was like, okay, I mean, where's that been all this time? Where do you find all these things?
Well, I tell people that I may forget where I put my keys, but I have my brain is a trash bin of trivia. Okay, all this stuff. And it's not been of much use until I started writing the book. Okay, but so, and I go back, plus you do a lot of awful research online. There's just a huge amount of information available, and it's just amazing the treasure trove of mistakes that you find in history. It made a huge difference. Let me give you one from book two. It's one of my favorites, and it's you can go to tinyblundersbigdisasters.com, and we have, among other things, there. It's kind of a fun place to visit with the portrait gallery and so on and so forth. It also has 3 Instagram reels, and here's the kind of the teaser from my favorite reel. It's I call it the John Wayne reel. It said, what outrageous character bought stolen horses from the Comanche Indians using counterfeit money? What could possibly go wrong? when the Comanche came back for revenge, it set off a chain of events that had a major impact on history of the Southwest. John Wayne later played this very colorful character in a John Ford movie with the help of Natalie Wood. It's a fascinating story.
Wow. I think that's just really fun. And so have you... I actually didn't look. I should have. Have you written other books outside of this?
No, I have a third book that I was working on. It was called The Hushed Up Murders of Famous People. They murdered big and got away with it, but my wife told me if I started one more book, she's going to leave me. she needs a lot of attention. It's okay, honey. Okay, whatever. So I'll just put that on hold. But sometime in the future, I will hopefully get it done, you know.
Well, we had Michael Pack on, the guy who made the film of the last 600 yards in the first hour, and I thought it was worth thanking you for your service because I saw in your bio that you're a decorated combat infantry officer in Vietnam and the 1st Air Cavalry Division. So we
thank you.
Yep, our hats off to you. And then in real life, you, you weren't writing books about the trash in your brain. it says here you were the vice president of sales and marketing and the marketing director in the home improvement industry.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yes, I've been retired now for about 2.5 years. And when I first started the book, I started like 11, 12 years ago, I had 5 children still at home. I had working full time, and I had a wife who needed attention. Well, since then, the 5 children have moved on. I have since retired, but I still have a wife who needs attention. Which is an important priority, as we all know. But I have fun writing the books, but I have fun being married too. So we'll arrange our priorities accordingly.
Well, and who put together the website?
Well, that was my daughter again.
Is that the same daughter?
The same daughter, and also with a lot of help from the other twin daughter, Mary Catherine. They were both great to help on terms of the technical side of things.
Oh, well,
I did.
Kudos to them. I really liked it. I thought it was really, it was well done, and it was really beautiful, actually. I thought that the map of the world behind it, and just the way they did it, and the quiz, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was one of those websites you kind of fall in, and all of a sudden you realize now you're late for some other stuff, and you've roped us into your madness.
Yes, it's kind of like a literary carnival to visit the website. We can all we have the 3 Instagram reels, we have a trailer, we have the fun quiz, the portrait galleries, and so forth. And so you can spend 15, 20 minutes there. They have 2 free chapters. And then we're going to add another chapter to it. Big chapters, the first 2.5 pages of Wrong Way Corrigan, which is a fun chapter. It's a real hoot. That's the chapter that Mensa is going to be publishing in their January edition. And it's for the headline is going to be up there backwards, Wrong Way Corrigan. It's almost spoiler for a bit. It's a fun, interesting story. Kind of a comic relief kind of a story. Plus, we got another favorite chapter. A lot of people is the Bismarck chapter. If you're a history buff, you'll love that one. There's a series of mistakes, both on the part of the British and on the part of the Germans. Back and forth, it's a question of whose mistakes are going to finally win out in the end. And it turned out to be that the British won. But it was funny at one part of the battle, running battle back and forth. These old biplanes take off from the Ark Royal aircraft carrier in a storm, and they're told that there's no other British ships in the area, which is not true. The Sheffield was in the area, and so they, in the storm, they get confused, and they come in and drop their torpedoes against a British ship, the Sheffield. Fortunately, it was a new kind of magnetic torpedoes, and they malfunction. But they could have just sunk one of their own ships just out of confusion. So they come back, they load up with the old-fashioned contact torpedoes, take off again. This time they find the Bismarck. They come in, they hit the Bismarck, and one of the torpedoes hits the rudder. Now the Bismarck can only travel in a very big circle, and they're able to come in and to sink it. But if it had been, except for those mistakes right there, there's also another mistake. German submarine had the Ark Royal in its sights, but if they had used up all their torpedoes, if they had saved it back two or three torpedoes, even one good torpedo, they could have sunk it. That would have changed the outcome. Also, he just kept, you know, one, here's one mistake, here's another mistake. The captain of the Bismarck broke radio silence, a big mistake. He was being warned not to. The British had lost it. They don't know where you are. Oh, what do you know? You know what I'm talking about. They kept on sending these long messages, breaking radio silence, and sure enough, the British pick him up, and they can start triangulating his position, but they make a mathematical mistake. They think he's heading to the north instead of the south. It took us 7 hours to discover, oops, we have a mathematical mistake. Oh, sorry, go back. So here's this one mistake, here's another mistake, here's this one mistake, here's another mistake. About 10, 12 mistakes, they finally determine the outcome with, the, of course, the British winning in the end.
by no fault of their own.
It all ended this great big victory. And it was a huge, very, very important, because Great Britain is very, very dependent on the caravans, the convoys coming from the United States. They don't have enough arable land to even feed themselves. And so without the convoys, they're in big, big trouble. And, of course, the Germans knew this, and the idea was to have a surface ship go out there and start sinking convoys right and left, in addition to the submarines, and that's why it was so important to sink the Bismarck.
Ah. Wow. I bet as you were finding these and putting, I'm curious, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to know how you decided what order you would put all these things in. I'm always curious what goes on in the background of how these things get put together. Mm-hmm. Our guest is Jared Knott. He's a historian and an author. The books are Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters. And I think we know him well enough to know that we have, like, the perfect song for him that probably plays in the, what is it, the trash of your mind?
The trash can.
Yes, the trash can of your mind, I believe, has a musical background. And we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome to my world. Won't you come on in? Miracles, I guess, still happen now and then.
I got a crazy teacher, he wears dark glasses. Things are going great, and they're only getting better. I'm doing alright, getting good grades. The future's so bright, I gotta wear shades. I gotta wear shades.
Okay, so welcome back to the world of Jared Knott. Jared, I'm super curious. How did you decide what order to put these in?
Yes, I chose my favorite chapters there in the beginning. The very first one was about the Rosenbergs, which was it was a shorter chapter, but it really epitomized how a tiny mistake can make such a big difference. The Russians, sending their codes using this pad, the code pad, is supposed to use one-time use. One of the clerks there in the war took a shortcut and he used it twice. That allowed the Americans to break the code. It allowed them to gather information that led to discovering that Rosenbergs were agents and that Rosenbergs were stealing the atomic bomb secret, and it led to them being put to death in the gas chamber. It was the electric chair. So that was just a short chapter, but here's this one little mistake, and boom, all these horrible things that came from it. And then the second one, chapter is the Bismarck, which is one of my favorite chapters. Now, by the way, let me back up. The introduction, which begins with literally with a bang, it begins with a volcano. That's one of my favorite chapters also. So there's a lot of fun chapters there. And by the way, switching over to a different subject, is that the and then also to follow through on that thought, then I would put down the chapters had to do with navigation in one category, and one had to do with politics in another category, and also one had to do with medicine. But that was a kind of a fun section there, the mistakes that were made in the medical field. with Professor Fleming discovering penicillin. That was a very fun chapter. But also talking about music, the Johnny Horton hit "Sink the Bismarck" for the early 1960s is kind of a fun song to listen to. It kind of tells the story of the Bismarck and put the lyrics.
I saw the other one here, the end of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Does it wreck us? Does it ruin it if you tell us the story?
No, not at all. In fact, that's one of the Instagram reels. And Elon Musk sent out a playful tweet. The teaser there is that the last vestige of the Roman Empire that was right there at this gigantic fortress, very successful fortress, it stood over 1,000 years. It had been under 26 major assaults. It had always been successful. But the it fell in large part because somebody forgot to close and lock a gate in the fortress wall.
Oh, boy.
it's not an overstatement to say the Roman Empire fell because somebody forgot to close and lock the gate. Well, so Elon Musk sends out this little playful tweet, and it shows a soldier in bed, cartoon, with a helmet on, his blanket pulled up to to his chin, and a balloon shows the spots, and it says, he's saying, "Did I remember to lock that gate yesterday?" And the answer, of course, is no.
No.
Turks were a little bit offended by it, because that was Ottoman Empire, so on and so forth. But anyway, that was what happened. And there's, in fact, there's three different stories in the book about how not closing and locking the main gate to a fortress led to the collapse and defeat of that fortress. It was one of Fort Mims was the commander, was Major Beasley was his name, was drunk and or hungover, and kept getting warned that the Red Stick warriors were coming, and he would identify that one slave had warned him, and he had him tied to the post, getting ready to whip him to death, and then here comes the attack, and here's a wide open gate, and so on and so forth, so he must have felt, and he's running to close the gate, and he gets shot and killed, so he must have felt very badly the last minute of his life. He had to die feeling stupid, and there's no way no worse way to die than that.
You gotta hate when that happens.
Yes, I hate when that happens, right? And there was that, but that kind of thing. And then there's also Fort Parker, and on like that. So there's a lot of fun events one after the other, in the book.
Wow, I just are some of them. Are these things that you've maybe you're interested in this for a long time, or did you just stumble across a couple of them, and then once you started looking, they just came out like a floodgate?
Yeah, I was interested in history since I was a teenager, but the very first one I happened to think of was the Watergate, the one I mentioned, and then, well, gee whiz, maybe that'd make a good magazine article. I thought of another one. I thought of another one going through my trash pen of a brain. That's 10 or 12. I got enough to write a magazine article. Okay, I kept digging. Well, there's another one. There's another one. And when you dig, it's just amazing how many screw-ups and mistakes and blunders there are throughout history. They have such a huge impact on the final outcome. And, of course, it's parallels the butterfly effect. There was a famous mathematician back in the 1950s. Lorenz was his name, and he was Professor Lorenz, and he was back then it took a long time for the computers to run all these computer programs making a projection of the weather. And he had this one number. It was a number with a decimal and 18 little small numbers behind it. He's taken so long for the computer to run these numbers, I'm going to whack off the last six of them, just have a decimal with 12 numbers behind it, they'll speed things up. He was amazed at how the outcome was so different when those six numbers were chopped off. And so it led him to conclude that a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil would set off a chain reaction that a year and a half later could lead to a cyclone in Texas. And that was the birth of the whole concept of the butterfly effect. And so it's a little bit analogous. You're leaving Seattle, Washington, and you're trying to get to London, and your compass is off by 1 or 2 degrees. You'd end up down in North Africa instead of London, that kind of thing. Yeah. So anyway, that's where the concept comes from, and this is the butterfly effect as it applies to history. And there's mistake after mistake over and over again. But now sometimes the mistakes have beneficial results. One example was Alexander Fleming. back in St. Mary's Hospital in 1928, and he was known for being something of a slob. And my wife tells me I could relate. anyway, so it kind of kept him a brilliant man, but kept a real messy lab. And he was getting ready to go to up to Scotland for 2 weeks on vacation. And, he has all these dishes, these petri dishes that have bacteria smeared in them. He just leaves them out there on his countertop, doesn't clean them up. I'll clean them up when I get back. Very key, leaves the window to the lab open. Okay, and off he goes to Scotland. Well, somehow, a spore, a penicillin spore, comes in through the window, blows around, and lands in one of the petri dishes. By the way, one of the biggest turning points in history. He comes back from vacation, okay, to his credit, he's looking through the petri dishes. What's this? This mold has landed right in the middle of one of the petri dishes and killed all the bacteria around it. It's kind of a halo around where it's located, and it's flourishing right there. The petri dish is surrounded by bacteria. Whoa! That means it's a killer. It's able to kill germs, able to kill bacteria. I should say, kill bacteria. Major breakthrough. And of course, it took a lot of many steps. He had to refine it, tested it again, et cetera, et cetera. And he was published in a small magazine. It was kind of ignored for 8 or 9 years. Another professor at a big laboratory discovers it, et cetera, one thing to another, to another, to another. It took 12 years, but finally they were able to produce it in large, large quantities, and it saved hundreds of millions, even billions of lives because of a mistake. So Professor Fleming is the patron saint of slobs everywhere, and we're very, very grateful.
You know, it is always nice when, you know, when they make you look good, huh?
Yeah. Right. Normally you make a mistake, it makes you look bad, but this is one of those rare exceptions.
Yeah, like, see? I told you. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, tell me this on this whole Mondami thing. What was, based on all these blunders and mistakes you've looked at through history, what was your thought on that?
Well, yes, I think it was been said that Mondami is a young man with very old ideas. Socialism has been proven to be a bankrupt idea and has failed over and over again. Coming out of Poland, there was an old kind of a saying, joke. They were saying that in socialism, whether you stand up or whether you sit down, you get paid the same wage. Well, that's one of the big problems with it. It does not reward people who work 16 hours a day, borrow money from their family, just work their heart out to open up a new restaurant, to open up a new home improvement business, whatever it might be, because if you do make a lot of money with the restaurant, the home improvement business, the government's going to come in and take it all away from you anyway. They don't want anybody making more money than other people.
Right.
So it ruins the incentive to work hard, ruins the incentive to innovate, and everything just flattens out. And that leads to failure after failure after failure. And so, one question, if I had the opportunity, I would ask Mayor Mondami, are you concerned that Wall Street is going to lose a large amount of its business to the Texas Stock Exchange, which is opening later next year? He should be very concerned because down in Texas, they have a very pro-business environment. Up in New York, under his leadership, they're going to have a very negative business environment, high taxes. And in Texas, they passed an amendment to the state constitution that there will be no taxes on financial transactions. Up in New York, they have heavy taxes on financial transactions. That along with the cost of living and many other factors, it's going to be much more profitable to do business in Dallas, Texas, with the what they call on Wall Street, with the new stock exchange that is up in New York. And some people are predicting that the New York Stock Exchange may fail and be replaced by the one down in Dallas and cost people in New York thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in tax revenue, et cetera, et cetera. So he's about to learn a lesson in free enterprise and competition. If you burden your situation, your offering with heavy taxes and heavy regulations and so on, you may find that it fails and you find yourself going out of business.
And dragging everybody else with you.
That's right. Down the drain.
It does. It's interesting. We interviewed another historian not that long ago, and it just blows my mind that this information is available, you know, on what happens with socialism in particular, and yet it seems that there's a really critical lack of knowledge.
Yes, there was a famous debate years ago between Phil Donahue and Milton Friedman, the famous economist, who Nobel Prize winning economist, talking about which is best, socialism or free enterprise. And Milton Friedman was making the point that no economic system has lifted more people out of poverty, created more prosperity than free enterprise. It unleashes very powerful forces, which drives the economy forward and creates many businesses and many jobs. You go back to almost every successful company we've had in the United States. You go back to Home Depot, to Hewlett Packard, just pick one out. It goes back to the very beginning. It was one or two or three guys really focusing on an idea, really believing in what they were doing, taking up working many long hours, borrowing a lot of money, and sometimes with the family, so on and so forth. They're making it work, making it work. At Home Depot, they failed the first time around, came back around successful the second time. All those businesses and all those jobs came from the entrepreneur. And without the entrepreneur, you have almost nothing. Now, the socialism is an easy sale. It's easy to say, vote for us, we're going to send you a federal check. Vote for us, we're going to tax billionaires, and we're going to give you lots of free buses and free payments of free tuition, et cetera, lots of free stuff. The problem is that, after Margaret Thatcher said, the problem is after a while you run out of other people's money.
Mm-hmm.
And it just fails. It just fails and falls apart time and time and time and time again. And that's the lesson they're going to learn up there in New York, especially if they lose all the financial business they have in Wall Street. It moves down to Dallas where it's so much more profitable. And by the way, a house in New York costs five times as much as a house down in Dallas, Texas. So they're going to find that the whole foundation of their financial markets may be in serious trouble in the next 12 months.
Mm. Wow. And that, where is that? I mean, that hasn't been really spoken about all that often.
Yeah, the people up there in New York, I mean, well, let's try something different. Well, he's promising this. He's promising government grocery stores. He's promising free bus lines. He's promising free daycare, so on, et cetera, like this. Well, okay, that's fine. It's always a big weakness, I guess, to capitalism, because the socialists said we can just promise you this and promise you this, and here comes this federal check. But you look at the record, and over and over and over again, it's just flopped and failed. And cause a great deal of misery.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to understand how so many people, I mean, New York's a big city, how so many people can believe that all that's going to happen when in the past it never comes to fruition. They can promise all they want, but when it comes time to doing it, I think I heard something the other day about he's trying to get enough money to get the free buses going, but he can't even do that. So it's kind of amazing to me that people are believing that this is all going to happen.
Well, you look at the track record, you make a very good point. You look at Detroit. It's been under Democratic leadership for at least, 20, 30 some odd years. Just a horrible mess. Look at Baltimore. Same thing. Democratic leadership under, it's a horrible mess. Look at California. They had the rail at high speed rail, $9 billion, have yet to get the first mile of it operating.
Yeah, we call that high cost rail.
Yes,
make sure you include a chapter of that in your next book, High Cost Rail.
Yeah, I'll make.
You'd have to do a whole book about the blunders, though. I mean, it's like you couldn't really narrow it down to one thing.
You could call it California Dreaming.
Like, yes, and they, of course, they can't manage their force out there. You go, you pull up all the bushes and all the shrubbery so it doesn't act as a stepping stone for the larger fires, et cetera. You also have water in your reservoirs. You also have
we want to make sure 50% of our water goes out for fish to the ocean.
Yes, the snail darter.
Yeah, we got to flush it all for fish because, you know, fish are, well, it's kind of funny because, you know, now we're having all this problem with wolves, and someone sent me a we're not the only state who has a problem with wolves, but somebody had sent me the California Fish and Game logo had been modified. It says California Department of Fish and Wolves, and underneath it says, because screw everything else. It's like, well, you know, I think we probably ought to adopt that logo. It's probably more accurate than what we've got going.
Well, you look at the Florida, which is a red state and a beautifully managed state. Whenever they have a hurricane coming, of course, they're plagued with hurricanes there. Governor DeSantis has like thousands of utility workers all lined up, standing and waiting. And as soon as the storm blew through, here they come, and they immediately get to work getting all the functioning of the power back in place. They had a bridge that blew down, they had it rebuilt in 3 days, just operating A-plus efficiency. And serving the people very well. Come to California, they're just flubbing all over themselves. I mean, they've got the homeless people out there defecating in the streets. They have drug laws. A lot of people not only dying from drug overdoses, but they're having their lives ruined because they're addicted. People that could be productive citizens, that could be fathers and mothers and holding good jobs, are just out there in the streets living in filth. It shows what happens when there's no discipline and those standards being maintained.
Well, you just keep making, I mean, you know, out here we, and, you know, honestly, the people who are representing California, they're not electing each other. You know, it's the people in the state who continue to, you know, like this Prop 50 that we've been really vocal about the last few months. You know, they've taken 52 members of Congress representing the state, and now it's whittled down to 4 districts that will be represented by Republicans, if in fact that is not repealed. So you look at that, and for a group of people who are supposedly really interested in fairness and, you know, democracy and all that, it's like, well, where does that factor in? So I don't know. It's a kind of a... got a little bit of a mental illness thing going on. We have to take a really quick break on that cheerful note.
That's very depressing. Thank you very much.
I did find you a couple of fun songs that fit in, though.
Oh, okay. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. So, you know, we got to kind of see what we can figure out. We'll be right back. Our guest is Jared Knott. He is the author of Tiny Blunders, Big Disasters. And I definitely think you'll enjoy it. 2 books, great read, and the website is fantastic. You can find all that info at
wethepeopleradio.us.
Was dying out. No one left to scream and shout. People walking on the moon. Smog will get you pretty soon. Everyone was hanging out.
Well, there you go. Ship of fools.
I was hoping you'd have Johnny Horton and Cynthia Bismarck, but I guess you couldn't find it.
I didn't have that one already in my thing. I mean, there's 616 choices.
That's a lot.
We're going to put Alex on the Bismarck, though, to close out. He's got time to find that.
If it makes you feel any better, I do have that album.
You can look it up on YouTube. YouTube is available there, too.
That's true. Oh, we do have the album at home. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
In the basement with the record player. Because we're nerds. So lots of bad choices with socialism, and yet New York felt the need to jump in the deep end.
Yes, going back to what I was saying, I mean, if you were to say, which of the two ideas is easier to sell to people, okay, to people who don't have a good historical reference, well, gosh, socialism is great. We're going to tax those billionaires, we're going to take that money, and we're going to pay for all college tuition, we're going to get a free bus line, we're going to give you government-run grocery stores, all these benefits are going to come showering on you. Billionaires, they won't mind. They've got enough money anyway. Well, okay, it's a great sale. And, of course, the affordability is an issue there in New York in particular. And people who don't, the old thing from George Santayana, those who fail to learn the lesson of history are doomed to repeat it. Never more obvious an example than this. We got people that were not well-educated about free enterprise back in high school and college with liberal professors and liberal teachers. Now we've got a bunch of sheep there that can be easily sheared and taken advantage of. And again, I'm a big believer in going on just to the basics. How important are the financial markets there in New York City? Well, they employ thousands of people, billions of dollars in taxes, billions of dollars in revenue coming into the city. You're in danger of losing most or all of that entire enterprise down to Texas. It's a very pro-business environment, and you're a very anti-business environment. You're about to pay a terrible price if you keep going down that road.
Yeah, I think you said it well. A lot of these people that are falling for this are people that haven't really taken advantage of free enterprise for whatever reason. No education, lack of motivation. And I don't know what it is, but you know, I think they look at it like, "Hey, I don't have anything now. What? How? It can't be any worse." Well, it certainly can be worse. It can be a lot worse.
Could you imagine free government grocery stores?
Yeah,
it kind of reminds me of way back when they first came out with. Remember when they first came out with generic and like cereal? It was just a white box with black writing that said cereal on it. So I picture the stores in New York, all the boxes are white with just black writing. Cereal.
I think they had one, I think in St. Louis, Missouri, they had a government-run grocery store, and it was out of stock and everything, and it just flopped. Just to stank the place up as such a fetter. It just doesn't work. You have to, the profit motive is so important on getting people out of bed in the morning, having to work long hours and being very motivated to perform well in their job. To avoid the consequences of failure, that's just the way things work. But again, you look at the record. Look at Detroit, disaster. Look at Baltimore, disaster. Look at California in so many ways. Still a lot of good things, but an awful lot of bad things that come from Los Angeles cities that are poorly run by blue governments. It's just you look at the people leaving California, leaving New Jersey, leaving Illinois, leaving. Yeah, of course, New York and the northern or eastern states, including down to Tennessee and to North Carolina, South Carolina, to Texas in particular, and also, of course, Florida and to some extent Georgia. They're leaving the failing states and moving to the prosperous states that emphasize free enterprise and, by the way, law enforcement. I mean, the two, one is succeeding and the other is failing.
Yeah, and it seems, you know, why is it so obvious to some and not to others?
I think a good example, too, years ago I used to sell retail into a lot of these little mini-marts and stuff, and I was having a conversation with the owner of one of these stores one day, and it was some holiday coming up, and I said, well, what are you doing for the holiday? He goes, I'm working. I go, you didn't take a day off. He goes, no. He goes, we don't take days off. He goes, this is why America, so many people in America don't have anything, is they're not willing to work. He goes, you can make all the money you ever wanted in America. He goes, you just have to work. And if you work, you'll make money. And when you make money, you can maybe buy another store. And then maybe that store will make more money and so on and so forth. But he said, the problem is Americans have gotten lazy. They take things for free, and they don't want to put in the hours it takes to be successful. And I thought, wow, here's a guy that came here from another country and has it figured out, and he's doing quite well. You know, everybody has that same opportunity. but you have to apply yourself. And I think that's where a lot of people are kind of missing the boat, is they depend too much on free stuff and how to get things without really working for it, which means when you do get it, you don't appreciate it. And so I mean, that I never forgot that. I thought, wow, it's true. I mean, a lot of these people you see out there don't want to work.
Yes, it's sort of like socialism appeals to the darker angels, or lazy angels of our nature. We're going to give you a paycheck, we're going to give you security, we're going to give you things, so you don't have to do much of anything, just vote Democratic, and we'll give it to them, you don't have to earn it. Well, that's a corruption, that nothing corrupts so much as being given the fruits of success without achievement.
All right.
And that's what the socialism does, appealing to the kind of the laziness in the nature of a lot of people, and which is too bad.
If it
hurts not to work hard, then you start working hard. If it doesn't hurt because the government came in to save you, then that's, again, mm-hmm. a very corrupt system.
Yep.
Yeah, the idea that that we tell people that if you have to work hard, that's abuse. You have 5 kids. I bet you're a terrible abuser. I know my dad was, and I know Bill's dad was. There's a lot of shoveling and raking and... A lot of shoveling and raking.
Well, there's no free ride. I mean, if socialism worked, every country on the planet would be a socialist planet.
Well, Cuba would be driving
country.
Newer cars, right?
That's right. I mean, everybody would be happy in those countries and be, you know, fully supported and happy and be able to do what they want and travel where they want. But there's no place like that.
Yes, it's funny. You compare 15, 20 years ago, the entire European economy was about the same size as the American economy. And we're not perfect over here, but we allow innovation and encourage innovation. If you were successful in your business, we didn't come in and try to take all the money away and taxes. Well, the top 7, I think, computer high-tech companies, their total worth is about now equal to all of Europe. Europe has fallen way behind. They don't have any of the kind of NVIDIAs or the kind of Broadcoms and so on that the United States has. They've regulated themselves into being a very non-competitive situation. Of course, China's competitive with us, and to some extent, well, maybe Russia to some extent. But the Europeans have become very non-competitive because they have a kind of a socialistic system that rewards complacency and not intense hard work.
Right.
it's amazing that you could even sell a thing like that, you know, ever. And socialism typically comes at the, you know, at the barrel of a gun, with the barrel of a gun. You know, it's usually something everybody agrees to.
And it's been around forever, and it's got a terrible track record. And I don't understand why people don't know that.
Well, yeah, they say everything that we do in life, eating a ham sandwich, to go to the grocery store, or watch a football game, everything you do in life is done for one of two reasons, either to avoid pain or to seek pleasure. And of the two of those, avoiding pain is the more powerful motivation. You can ask any drill sergeant, you'll do a lot more to avoid pain, a lot more to keep from making an F than you will to go from a B to an A, do a lot more to keep from getting fired than you would to getting promoted. Pain is a powerful motivator. And, of course, the Democratic Party comes in, socialists come in and say, listen, you don't all you have to do is vote for us. We'll take care of this. We're going to tax those billionaires. We're going to get that money. Here's all this nice, soft, cushy benefits that we're going to give to you. And so vote for us. So it's a very easy thing to sell on the surface. The problem is it just doesn't work. In fact, it causes huge, huge pain down the road. And I think New York is going to learn what Baltimore and Detroit and parts of California have already learned. Hopefully, it won't be too late before they can turn it around.
What's your? I hate to make you have a prediction, but how long do you think it'll take New York to figure this out? That it's going to be a total disaster.
I don't know if it's going to happen in 2 years, but within 4 years, and again, especially, and a lot of people are predicting, they're saying the Dallas stock market is going to take over all of the what's now currently taking place in Wall Street and New York. If they lose Wall Street, they lose 70-80% of the business that's in Wall Street, and jobs are lost.
Oh yeah, they're
lost.
Doomed.
That's going to be a huge, embarrassing disaster, and it's going to say, "Well, see, we tried to tell you, and you wouldn't listen."
When is that slated to take effect?
Yeah, now Goldman Sachs is I think it's an 800,000 square foot building they have put down there. They have most of their employees are now already in Dallas. I think Oppenheimer and J.P. Morgan have already moved down there. The Texas stock market is going to open sometime next year. I'm not sure when, but it will open up. And there will be no good reason to stay in New York City when you can move to Dallas. And, again, the taxes are a fraction.
Yeah, and you can do well.
Is a fraction. Yes, and so it may kick the stuffing out of New York in short order. We'll see.
Bummer. Jared, we have run out of time.
Okay.
We don't want to have a tiny blunder or a big disaster on this. But we did find Joni Horton for you.
Oh.
So we're going to go out on top, huh?
Great. That's a great question. TinyBlundersBigDisasters.com. It's a fun place.
Yes,
I'm looking forward to this song.
All right. Thanks very much. You're listening to We the People,
it.
And you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Of 1941, the war had just begun. The Germans had the biggest ship that had the biggest guns. The Bismarck was the fastest ship that ever sailed the sea. On her decks were guns as big as steers and shells as big as trees. Out of the cold and foggy night came the British ship, the Hood. And every British seaman, he knew and understood. They had to sink the Bismarck, the terror of the sea. Top those guns as big as steers and those shells as big as trees. We find that German battleship is making such a fuss. We gotta sink the Bismarck, cause the world depends on us.
Hit the decks are running, boys, and spin those guns around.
But when we find the Bismarck, we gotta cut her down.